Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Now, back to America This Week, live on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
This is Tim Reedy sitting in for Father Matt Malone, who is traveling. I believe he's at his niece's graduation, so this is graduation season, so we're all going to ordinations and graduations.
And reunions.
And reunions, yes, I had my college reunion this weekend. That was fun. 20 years out of college. So
20 years out of?
Princeton.
Princeton,
yes.
Let's say it. Good job. Well done.
I've got
you
my 5 year at UVA this weekend.
Wow.
I'm not going, but I...
The fifth is the most fun.
I know,
because everyone's still like young and happy.
I went from the different, like at Princeton, they have them in different quads. So you can go to the fifth, you can go to the 10th. And the fifth and the 10th definitely look like more fun.
Regret this.
The 20th, it was, they had a band and there were like 10 people dancing and everybody was just talking.
So did you have fun or you didn't have fun? No, I did.
Okay. No, it was fun. I mean, it's nice to connect with people. You know, it's funny, some people who like you're really close friends with in college, you know, you're like, oh, I don't have as much to talk to you about as I did. And it's kind of bittersweet because he's like, these are really close friends and like, you feel like you could still be close friends, but just because of distance and time, you are not.
Right.
On the other hand, there are people you meet who are like, we were not close friends, but we could be friends now because like we actually have a lot more in common than we did 20 years ago. So so that's nice. And of course, I brought my family, so it was fun. I mean, a lot of kids, and so that was fun, everybody to get to meet people's kids. But I'd say, like, you know, 72 hours was enough. Like, after 3 days of, yes, it was, it
did
was
they
a
have,
lot.
Did they have kids?
Bouncy castles,
like, oh,
they did.
Okay. Did they have adult bouncy castles as well?
There were some undergrads in there at, late right. at night, but... they were discouraged from doing so. But yes, it's quite an event and it's fun, but you know, they have a big parade through campus and we all dressed up in costumes. It's
tiger costumes or
there's a theme. Okay, not to get too deep into this, but there is a theme for every fifth year. We were Tigeritaville was our theme. So we all had Hawaiian shirts and Hawaiian hats. And beach blankets, and yeah, and then there's a float.
Great.
But did it have to be like tiger themed Margaritaville, or was it just Margaritaville?
No,
but it was, you would wear Princeton gear or something.
No, it was Margaritaville, but no, we had to buy the outfits. So they all had like, I'll show the picture.
Wait, but you had like a uniform?
Yeah, there's a uniform. Everybody gets uniforms. Like one year we had, there was James Bond,
and
we all wore.
About this like this is a normal thing.
You have to go. It's nuts.
Whoa.
Yeah, so the best one, I'll just say this, was the 10th reunion was wet, hot Princeton summer, and they were all wearing like big, long socks and the jean jackets from that movie, Wet Hot American Summer, which was pretty cool.
I get the reference.
I saw the Netflix revival.
She's so young.
So it is that time of year.
All right.
But
the time where Tim buys his Princeton uniform.
Yes.
And then where's are there pictures? Why are there no pictures on our office Slack messages?
I will share them in some private channels. I'm not going to share this. But it was fun.
Phone.
It was fun, you know. Right. And but we got 5 more years before the next one. So I got to take a break. But but we get to talk about Mr. Rogers again. We talked about Mr. Rogers a few weeks back when we had David Dark on the show about the wisdom of the original Mr. Rogers. We're talking now about the extraordinary life of China's Jesuit Mr. Rogers. This is actually somebody I did not know about until our contributor, Father Jim McDermott, wrote about it for us just last week. So Father Jerry Martinson passed away at age 74 just recently, and he spent pretty much all of his Jesuit life in China and Taiwan. And it's just kind of a reminder of the amazing work that Jesuits are doing abroad that you don't always know about because, you know, these are different cultures and people are, you know, gone for, you know, decades. And essentially, they have a new life there. So Father Martinson was very involved in television in China and actually had a show on television where he was kind of like the China Captain Kangaroo / Mr. Rogers, where he did music.
He had songs, right? And
yeah.
He would like talk about values and try to kind of put like a little
There's a little Christianity in there.
But like not enough to get him...
Right,
you know,
so he didn't talk about Jesus specifically, but he did talk about parables. So very much reminded me of, you know, people like Matteo Ricci and other Jesuits who were in China and did exactly that, which is like use the culture in a way that could introduce the message of Christianity, but in a way that was more acceptable.
Right. And wasn't coercing people into anything.
So, but we've had a lot of feedback to this article because people who knew him said he was an incredibly gentle, wonderful guy who did just wonderful work, you know, but from California and was there for 50 years. And you can Google him on YouTube and you can see some of his videos. So Father Jerry Martinson, he also served as an advisor. This was near the end of his life, of course, on the film Silence, which we've talked about on the show because they did a lot of their filming out there. And he was on site where Father Jim Martin was doing some advising here. He was out there talking to them. So it was really an amazing guy.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating, and it really made me want to just go look this up and be like, what does this actually look like? I mean, in the Jim McDermott writes that, you know, like he was so popular that later in his life he was just walking down the street in Taipei and a woman came out and just started sort of singing one of his songs to him, like this kind of level of celebrity, right? And this person was actually one of his students because he was teaching as well. So it's such a interesting way in which people can really just kind of have such a broad impact and an interesting sort of juxtaposition of cultures, because it's not something that I would have thought would have become this kind of phenomenon that it seems to be.
Yeah, and you know, again, a Jesuit, he probably didn't start off his career thinking I'm going to go into children's television, but you know, he kind of followed where the spirit led, and he had certain talents. He, you know, he taught himself, as Jim says, like how to play guitar, kind of on a boat ride, and you know, just kind of an amateur who excelled at this and really touched a lot of people's lives. So yes, again, the name Father Jerry Martinson, you can find that article at americamagazine.org.
Yeah, and I mean, it's an interesting place to do it because of that sort of conflict in China often between church and state, particularly the Catholic Church and the state there. And where there is still a little less conflict in some senses, but much less conflict, but some of the questions are still alive in our own universities here in our country, that question of church and state, and specifically for academics, for people teaching theology, how are you able to do that in a public university if you can't teach it sort of as literal gospel, right? So Nicole Flores, who we mentioned earlier, is a assistant professor at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia, is going to talk with us a little bit about how she does that, because that's exactly what she does every day. Nicole, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's good to hear from you.
Yeah, we're really glad to have you on. And Ashley, go ahead and do your cheer again. There's some cheer that's...
Wahoo-wah.
Sip, apparently this means something to you as well, Nicole.
It means much more to Ashley.
You don't go to the football games, Nicole?
I haven't been to a football game yet, but I have been introduced to the doctrine of Wahoo-wah.
There are many stories behind it. The origin story that I know is that a wahoo is a fish that can drink its weight in water. So students can drink their weight.
Oh, that's a nice,
other
sweet sentiment. I'm sure this is what you were hoping to talk about today, Nicole.
They're
right.
Very smart. They can drink their weight in reading. Mm-hmm. In words.
So probably this is not, you know, the key point of your lectures, Nicole. So I wonder, so you started out your academic career. You started out at St. Anselm's, a Catholic college in New Hampshire. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And recently moved to the University of Virginia, as we said. Can you talk a little bit about what motivated you first to work at a Catholic university, and then at what point you thought you might like to make this change?
Well, I actually hadn't anticipated an academic career for myself, even when I was pursuing my master's degree, and even a little bit into my doctoral work. I kind of got into it to think more about the relationship between theology and particular social movements, and I thought that the studies would be instructive there. But I did my doctoral work at Boston College, and everybody there just really embodied this vision of what a Catholic university and a Jesuit university specifically could be and what it could offer to students in terms of reflecting on not just on the tradition, but on how that affected their lives. So I think I've really I've really taken in that tradition of Jesuit intellectual life, and I appropriated it for myself. So that was my motivation for applying to St. Anselm College. Actually, there's a well-worn path between BC and St. A's in terms of faculty, students, a lot of interaction between the two of them. And St. Anselm College has a really rich Benedictine tradition that valued theology as a cornerstone of all work that happens there, to a greater or lesser extent, depending on which corner of the college community you're dealing with. But I'm still unclear for myself how I ended up at UVA. I have a colleague who was a professor of mine at Yale Divinity School, who invited me to apply. This is Willis Jenkins, who's a brilliant theologian and ethicist. And I didn't see myself really, leaving the Catholic fold, or really St. Anselm College at the time. But the way that the members of my department at UVA, now my colleagues, presented the vision was just so compelling that our interests in theology and public life could live there, and they could thrive there. And they gave me a lot of examples of how that worked or could work, or how they saw it working potentially for me. So it was a hard decision, because I really felt like intellectually and personally I flourished in the Catholic communal context, and I didn't exactly know what to expect arriving at UVA. But it's been an interesting journey, let's put it that way.
Yeah, so UVA was founded by one of our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, who famously called for a wall of separation between church and state. So that's a pretty, that's a stark change from what you were doing at St. Anselm. So how did that wall of separation play out either between you and your colleagues or in the classroom?
Yes, well, it's interesting. The UVA Religious Studies department is fabulous. I think it's the best department in the whole world. But one of the interesting aspects of it is that we have scholars from various methodological backgrounds kind of working together. So I'm not the only theologian in the department, and there's lots of people who work in methods within histories of religion or within scripture and exegesis, et cetera. So within the department, it was easy enough to find some space to have those conversations. But where I felt the tension was when I would have conversations either with colleagues in other departments or in the classroom. I think the place where there's been the most kind of tension and need for negotiation of those of that wall, if you will, has been within the classroom. Because of course, when I was teaching at a Catholic school, there was no pressure to present theology as anything but confession, but truth. In fact, at St. Anselm College in the handbook, I don't know if this is still there, if it's been revised out yet, but when I first started at the college, there was an invitation for professors to pray before class. And that is not an invitation that the professor that you hate.
Mr. Jefferson did not make that call.
He did not want us praying before class. but what he did want, I think, is a genuine exchange of ideas, a pursuit of tough questions. And I think some of the toughest questions facing our Commonwealth right now, facing our world, as former Secretary John Kerry has emphasized in America Magazine, some of those toughest questions require us not just to look at religion kind of from a step removed, but really engage the theological traditions of the and practices and lived reality of people who believe. So I think that's that's where I've been able to navigate this wall. I think it's a wall, but I don't think it's as high a wall as I initially thought. You know, so when I'm in the classroom, it's very important to me to make sure that there's space for students who don't share my personal theological beliefs, which is essentially every student, even Catholic students. There's disagreements among Catholics over doctrine, over the teachings of the church, or how those ought to be applied in real life. But of allowing space for reflection on those themes, and really for each person, each student, to engage their own worldview, whether this is oriented by a religious tradition or by philosophical or political commitment, I think that there I found some space there for introducing theology as a discipline, as a tradition that has method, that has content, that has things that are knowable to people who aren't Catholic and don't affirm the Catholic tradition as their own faith. I've been able to introduce that in that way.
Now, Nicole, it's nice to hear from you. We were together, I think, last year at the Catholic Theological Society, so that's coming up this week. But I'm interested. So the classes that you took, like I took a class in American Catholic Studies at a secular university, but it was purely kind of from a historical standpoint. But it sounds like you're actually assigning people theology to read. If that's the case, what are you choosing, what's the reaction?
That's a great question. So my particular areas of expertise are in Catholic social thoughts and in Latinx theology and ethics. So a lot of the work is just material that I've used in my own research, whether this is Ignacio Echeverria, or I assigned a book by Megan Clark, who writes in the pages of America and on the website. And so it's real theology, and both Echeverria and Clark are robustly confessional in their work. So the challenge then, it's not really different than what I would be assigning if I were working at St. A's. Actually, I didn't really tweak my readings all that much in the transition from the syllabus there to the syllabus at UVA. Where the real difference has been is how I introduce the material and frame the questions that we ask about them. It's interesting. You mentioned that conference last year. One of my inspirations for actually thinking about this question came up last year. I was in a conversation with a colleague who was really genuinely confused by my teaching at UVA. You know, this person asked, "Oh, so what are you teaching?" And I said, "Oh, I'm teaching a class on Catholic theology." He said, "Well, what are you assigning?" I think I was standing at the liturgical press table, and I said, "Well, some books here, you know, that are for sale at this conference." He's like, "Really? Can you do that?" And you know, it was kind of a little bit who's on first. He's like, "Theology, yes. At a public university, yes. Catholic theology, yes." So it's really interesting. I think I've found a way to assign those same things, but I think it's so important, and Ashley, I'd be curious in your perspective on this too, as somebody who had graduated. It's so important to allow that space for students to ask questions and to relate to the material from outside of the material and to be very critical of it. So it's hard sometimes because I'll assign something that I love and students, you know, completely reject it, and I kind of have to be ready for that and ready to engage in an intelligent conversation with them across some kind of either religious or political difference in order for us to come to understand that text better together, if that makes sense.
It does make sense, and I'm also interested to hear Ashley's response to that question, but we're going to give her a minute to think about it, and we're going to go to a break first, but stay with us. When we come back, you're going to hear more from Professor Nicole Flores of UVA, and more of her reflection coming from her article recently in the pages of America and at americamagazine.org called "In Jefferson's Shadow, Can Catholic Theology Thrive at a Public University?" Sounds like the answer is going toward yes.
Ashley, you attended Mr. Jefferson's University, as UVA is known, and were there classes like this available to you? Or, I mean, as a Catholic at a secular university, how did you go, you know, were you trying to learn more about the Catholic tradition, and were there options available to you?
Yeah, so I graduated with a degree in religious studies. So I did not plan on doing that. I had applied to the business school. My plan was to go into the business school, but I kept taking classes in the religious studies department, and so I can endorse what Nicole said, that it really is a wonderful department, just like full of amazing professors. So I kind of fell into religious studies because of how compelling it was. But I came from a background where I had gone to public school my entire life, so I didn't really expect to find confessional theology in the classroom. So when I was I took classes on American Catholicism, and I took classes on Islam, and I took classes on Buddhism, and in each of those I was interested in learning about the tradition, but I was not expecting a homily or expecting the professor to assume that I believe what they believe. So it was an enriching experience, but I also didn't feel like I had to hide my faith at all. I could make truth claims and people would challenge them and the professor might challenge them, but I did not feel like I was being stifled or that kind of talk was not welcome or was crossing the wall in some way.
So is that, Nicole, I mean, your students, you said sometimes there can be some tension there. I guess it's mixed in terms of the way students respond.
Yeah, well, and I think one of the reasons that I've had students respond wanting a little bit more to talk about their particular faith or wanting more from me in terms of the material on that end is that I make a choice in the classroom, which not all of my colleagues make, and I respect their reasons why, but I do not hide my personal commitment to Catholicism from my students. Now, there's other professors who do share their own religious background and practices with students, but I've actually found in conversations with my colleagues that there's some people who won't and who don't think it's a good idea. They think it poisons the well for the class, and I think that's a completely reasonable approach to this. Now, I do this for a couple of different reasons. First of all, a simple Google search reveals that
you're contributing.
You know, I can't get around it. And one thing that I really want to bring into my classrooms is engagement with technology and having a digital life that's an extension insofar as it can be of authentic human interaction. So if I want to model that for students in a way that I think will be valuable for their education, then I can't in good conscience not share of my public writing, of my thoughts on these things, and so much of it is about Catholic theology and Catholic belief. I find that does invite students to bring their particular beliefs into the classroom, but it's in discussing those beliefs that and getting down into the details and allowing them to be there, not in the abstract or not in the possibility that we disagree on things and some, behind some veil of ignorance, to use the Rawlsian language around it. But we're actually there disagreeing with each other. And I think that does create tension in terms of, you know, I have a lot of students who are from an evangelical Christian background. I'm very sympathetic to that tradition. Actually, my husband's evangelical. So this, you know, their concerns, their theological concerns are not new to me, but there's this constant back and forth even about sources. So I want to read A. Korea. My students want to read the Bible, and we have a kind of a back and forth about why do Catholics value tradition or what's the emphasis on scripture relative to the reflections of our traditions or magisterial teaching, etc. And I think some of the tension really comes up in those spaces, but I do think it's positive because we're actually encountering the other tradition rather than rather than just kind of speaking about it in an abstract way. So
right.
That's in my experience of attention. But I do, as I highlighted in the article, I think that that honesty, that authenticity is so important when the chips are down, when something happens in the world that really disrupts what everybody thought to be the situation, and it creates space for a not just a civil conversation, but maybe even one, to use the language that David Dark introduced in his piece a couple of weeks ago, a conversation of neighborliness and wanting to engage someone with an eye toward their value as a human in mind, and knowing that the disagreements don't have to overwhelm. So I think that's really been the benefit of that approach, even though there's a lot of risk.
Right. That makes sense. You write also that folks are sometimes well versed in this sense of American individualism, and sometimes skeptical of that call to communion. You write that orients the Catholic life. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because that in some ways is, there's a certain conversation I think that can be had when you're coming from two different faith backgrounds, but if you're coming from a background that's not really oriented toward that faith or that community of faith, and trying to enter into it in a class, it could provide points of conflict as well.
Yeah, that one's a tough one, because I think for me, it's an internal conflict. You know, I was raised Catholic, and I'm still Catholic, but I'm also a person of the United States, and I'm a millennial. I'm grandma millennial, but I'm still millennial, very old millennial. So my internal inclinations can sometimes be, well, let's just live and let live. Well, you know, they want to have their worldview over there. Well, they should go over there, and I'll stay over here, and we won't encounter each other. And that, I think that's just not realistic anymore. And I think that the students I have today get that even more so than our parents or grandparents' generations, that we can't avoid each other, and we're trying really hard to do that and maintain a robustly individualistic view of society, of the economy, of politics, of religion, and it's just not tenable anymore. So I do think that there's already that there's a desire, you know, to live and let live, or, you know, I want to do my own thing and I don't want you to interrupt it. But I think there's also a sense that we can't avoid each other any longer. So students, I think, come in resisting this, but see the wisdom in thinking about how it is we're connected to other people, what we owe to other people, just walking down the street, or other people living in our society, and having that robust debate on whether or not we do owe anything to anyone. And I think those ideas presented in that way, as opposed to, you know, in a very, again, very abstract way, you know, we're all connected to each other. The theological anthropology suggests that we are, you know, inherently relational by virtue of our creation and image of God. I love that, but they're less into that. So I think we've had some great productive conversations on reflecting on how it is that we as particular persons, rather than, you know, isolated individuals, how we can come into community and promote the flourishing of other people, rather than just trying to not bump into each other as we do our own thing.
Well, I'm kind of reminded as you're speaking about another David Dark quote. His book is "Life's Too Short to Pretend You're Not Religious," which it strikes me when you're both, you know, Ashley and Nicole, both millennials, that it, you know, you were comfortable saying, you know, talking about your faith in those settings, where I think. I was also a religion major at a secular university, and I think it was something more that the professors, even if they were people of faith, wasn't something they spoke about. They did kind of keep that strict boundary, and the students weren't so much encouraged to talk about it either. Sometimes it would come up naturally, like people who had sometimes concerns about, like, historical criticism of the Bible, for example. Mm-hmm. That was a real kind of controversial point, but it's maybe a generational, people are becoming more comfortable talking about this. And maybe, as you say, Nicole, it's because you can't avoid it and social media, et cetera. Like,
right. People can know in 30 seconds whether or not we're Catholic. They're going to find out.
Yeah.
And I think people are also used to, in some ways, being just more confessional in general. Like, there's so many ways to just say something about who you are online that it's bound to come up at some point in some way. In some way or another. Nicole, we have 2 minutes left on the show. So in the next 45 seconds, if you could give us a quick bit of advice about how to have these conversations sort of outside of the academic world, is there anything that you've found that has been helpful in having conversations about sort of navigating these ideas of faith and public life?
I think in terms of... I can offer advice in terms of internal disposition, because even as we were saying, yeah, we're more confessional today. I don't know about you all, but I feel like I have to hide some things about the things that I genuinely think, because I don't know if my interlocutor is going to be, or sorry, my conversation partner is going to be generous or open with that. So as we're having these kinds of conversations, they are very difficult, but somehow signaling or even just being internally oriented toward receiving what the other person is bringing to the table and giving some space for honesty and authenticity, I think that can go a long way. I think that generates trust. I think that leads to a better conversation.
I think it does as well. Conversation is going to be ending, but if you want to hear more from Nicole Flores, you can go to americamagazine.org. You can subscribe to America at 1-888-322-8465. Nicole, thanks so much for being on the show. And for Ashley McKinless and Tim Reedy, this is Carrie Weber, and we are America This Week. See you next week.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.